Life is heavy these days, isn't it? Complicated and contentious, and lots of us are struggling with simple things like how do we talk to people, often people we love, who are on the other side of some of the most important issues of our time. I grew up in a Sicilian family, and not to perpetuate a stereotype, but we were good at arguing. In Sicilian families, there is the Pope, pasta, and passionate, not polite, but passionate argument. Consequently, for much of my life, I would engage in arguments about faith, the Bible, the end times, the political implications of following Jesus, thinking that if you would only listen, I could convince you to see it my way. But argument and debate are something like a fool's errand these days. I mean, we have alternate facts and fake news, and I've realized that so many of us do things backwards. Instead of observing reality as honestly and objectively as possible and trying to live in that reality or to change that reality to make it better for more of us, instead, we develop an internal reality, an ideology or a worldview that's often completely impervious to a more objective reality. The Earth is the center of God's universe, and so, Copernicus and Galileo, get your scientific proof out of here. You must be wrong. Politics is a messy business, and women's delicate constitutions cannot take it, so don't get yourself all riled up about women voting, Miss Susan B. Anthony. Look, the Bible clearly says that the earth was created in 6 days, about 6,000 years ago. And this 4-billion-year-old earth stuff is just people trying to marginalize God. So I don't want to hear all of that physics, Dr. Einstein. It really doesn't make sense to argue with people like that. And the truth, it seems to me, is that most of us are people like that. So I've resigned from the Sicilian debate team and joined the Storytellers Club. When it comes to talking about important matters in life, matters of faith or politics or our relationships, these days I just try to tell the story of my own journey and talk about what I currently see from my particular spot on life's journey. Now, I say all of this because I spent last weekend in Asheville, North Carolina, with a bunch of storytellers at a conference called the Porch Gathering. The metaphor behind the gathering is sitting on the front porch, having a conversation where we talk about the most difficult and important matters we face in life, in America, and in our world. And the motive behind the porch is equipping people to build a better world through telling better stories. So, we listened to each other's stories, and we celebrated the stories that have been meaningful to us. But we also spent some time thinking about how those stories have caused harm to some, and led to so much division and conflict, and about how we can articulate better stories that are healing and uniting, and can serve as foundations for respect for and celebration of the other, whoever they are. During that weekend, I talked to a number of different people who shared wisdom and insight that I will be sharing with you over the next few weeks and months on this program. This program is Next 2.0 on WQLN NPR. Next is produced by the Public's Voice Media. If you want to know more about Next, you can go to Facebook and like our page, or Instagram and follow Next 2.0 Erie, where you can keep up with upcoming show promos and events and clips about what's next for our community and our democracy. Next 2.0 is hosted by Marcus Atkinson, but not today. I will be your host today. I am Chuck Camerata, and today we're going to share with you a short interview we did with the instigator of the Porch Conference, Gareth Higgins. Gareth was born in Belfast. He grew up during the years of Catholic-Protestant conflict there. His experience growing up and his involvement in the building of bridges of understanding between those groups has shaped his adult life and work. He writes and speaks about the power of storytelling to shape our lives and our world, and to make peace and instigate justice. And he also talks about how to take life seriously without taking yourself too seriously. He has a PhD in sociology from Queen's University in Belfast, and he helped teach the world's first graduate course in reconciliation studies at Trinity College in Dublin. And he has done a pile of other really interesting stuff, including founding The Porch magazine, which sponsors The Porch Gathering, and writing several very good books, including How Not to Be Afraid Anymore, about which we interviewed him on this program a couple of years ago. I had an absolute ball at this conference with a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me, from whom I learned a bunch. It was a weekend filled with rich conversations, deep reflection, laughter, and hope. So here is my conversation with Gareth Higgins. I hope you enjoy. So I'm here with Gareth Higgins, who is the instigator of the Porch Gathering here in Asheville, North Carolina. And we are having a great time with a lot of people here in Asheville. And the focus of the conference has to do with getting people together to tell story, and lots of things having to do with the stories that we tell, and how meaningful they are and how they impact our lives and our world. So I want to start, Gareth, by asking you how you came to see that we live by stories or narrative, and that those stories shape our world.
Well, what I always think about when somebody asks me that is, when I was 8 years old, my mother took me to see the movie about Gandhi's life. Hmm. And I have a very strong memory of this. It's over 40 years ago. Hmm. Now, getting to the Upper Ormo Road, the Curzon Cinema, and seeing a line of people around the block. We would have said queue and street, not
yes,
line and block.
Yes, I get it.
And because I grew up in Belfast, and we couldn't get in the first night. And, you know, when you're 8 years old and you don't get your ice cream, you have feelings about it. But that kind of marked me, because I really wanted to see this. And and I asked my mother recently, you know, why did you take me to see Gandhi? We did. We went back the next week and we got in this time. And I just have the strongest memories of being enveloped by that film. And she said, I thought it was important for you to know about this great man and what he had done. Now, I could ask her, why did you think that was important? And she would probably say, I don't know. You know,
might she have thought that's important because of the situation in which you lived in Belfast?
You know, here's the thing about that. That's a very logical question to ask. But I think a lot of people my parents' generation who were born before the outbreak of the violent civil conflict that some people call the Troubles, and who had lived with relative peace, although sectarian social relations weren't great in the 50s and early 60s. And I think a lot of people of my parents' generation didn't associate their lives with life outside, that it would almost have been arrogant for my mum to think that what Gandhi was doing had anything to do with Northern Ireland. That I mean, my mum was nearby, I think, on at least two occasions when bombs went off.
Wow.
And worse than that, I mean, she was directly bereaved through murder. You know, one of her close friends was murdered when mum would have been 21 or 22, is before I was before I was born. And to this day, my mum would say, I don't really feel like the Troubles affected me directly because she wasn't directly physically injured herself. And there's a lot of people like her who, because of a sort of a cultural low self-esteem, and also, you know, you don't talk about this kind of stuff. I don't think she validates her own courage or validates her own experience. Now there's another side to that. The pendulum can swing the other way, where people live entirely out of a victimization narrative, or they turn it on other people, or they are kept for political reasons by interests that manipulate them. They are kept as victims because it's in the selfish party interest to keep some groups of people as our, like, our totems of victimhood. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't honor people's victimhood, but you don't honor victimhood by weaponizing it.
Yeah.
You don't actually help people repair, if repair is even the right word, or find a way to live by obsessing with retribution, or by disproportionately interpreting the victimhood and making it bigger than it was. You know, for the person who's been victimized, it's their universe.
Yeah.
It's not my job to make it worse. It's not my job to weaponize it against other people. What my job to do is, if I'm not the victim, if I'm seeing the person who's suffering, my job is to do what I can to protect them. My job is to do what I can to help them have their needs provided for. My job is to do what I can to help ensure that the person who caused the victimhood doesn't do it again. And then to look towards some kind of process of accountability and amends. And maybe this is a lifelong journey.
Yeah.
And we have the privilege of doing this with a small number of people in our lives, unless it's what we do as our work. And maybe we get to be that person sometimes who gets supported in that way. At any rate, I don't think Mum was thinking about the Troubles when she took me to Gandhi. Mm. I just think my mum has a compassionate, open heart. Mm. And my dad would have taken me to Gandhi too. Mm. It was later he strongly encouraged me to watch One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when I was 13, he and my mum together. And so, you know, to respond to your question about when did I start thinking about narrative, I could say it was when I saw Gandhi, and then 5 years later when I was 13 when I saw One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And what I was seeing in both those films was people who were not like me. They were about as far away from me as you can imagine. You know, in the Indian independence movement in the 1930s and 40s, and a mental institution in the 1960s in Oregon. I didn't even know what Oregon was. I mean, seriously, you know the way words manifest to you as a child? I thought Oregon had something to do with oranges, you know. And it seemed like it might as well have been India. And so these people were not like me at all. And yet they were entirely like me, and I was entirely like them, that I could identify with. You know, when Gandhi gets thrown off the train, when he's in South Africa and he's a lawyer and he's wearing a suit and he gets thrown off the train because he's insisting he has a first class ticket, he's entitled to use it, but because of racism, he gets thrown off the train. I could feel that's wrong. That's wrong. And then I could feel in the institution in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest when McMurphy, who's Jack Nicholson's character, tries to generate enough votes to be allowed to watch the game on TV, and the nurse, through ideological purity, which is not a term I even would have been aware of at 13, authoritarian oppression comes into place. I'm like, that's wrong. Later it kind of became a more sophisticated view of who am I in these stories. And I have to contend with the fact that where Gandhi is concerned, I'm not Gandhi, right? And I'm not the British imperial superstructure either, but there are parts of each in me. And in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, I'm not McMurphy or the Chief, and I'm not Nurse Ratched, but I have parts of all of them in me.
Yeah.
And who am I going to listen to?
Yeah.
Which parts of the story am I going to listen to? So somebody who knows me better than I do could x-ray my brain and say, actually, Gareth, you started thinking about narrative when you were 6 or when you were 24. I don't know. But those are the two big moments that came to mind for me.
So what in thinking about narrative, and you have a passion for film as well, which is another form storytelling.
Yeah.
So in thinking about narrative stories, what do you see that is, how does story impact us? And maybe we can talk a little bit about the downside, the negative stories that we tell in our culture.
Well, I do think that there's ancient wisdom in many spiritual and religious and philosophical traditions that is backed up by contemporary neuroscience and psychology. Absolutely. And sociology, right, that says that stories are how we make sense of our lives, and that what's happening to you, there may only be a tissue paper thin line between what's happening and the story you tell about it. You know, I could punch you in the arm right now. I'm not going to do that. But if I punched you in the arm right now, there would be the impact of the punch physically, which would be different for you than any other person I could punch. Hmm. I don't go around punching people, by the way. Your experience of the punch would be different for you than any other person. The meaning of the punch would come down to the story you tell about it. It could be a punch intended as a sort of an affectionate, catch yourself on, you know, stop being so down on yourself, or, catch yourself on, stop being so stupid, right? Yeah. Like, or it could be an aggressive punch, or it could be I slipped and fell into you and punched you. So it's the story you tell about the punch that gives meaning to it. You might also have a really unhealthy story, like I deserve to be punched. And so, like, at the level of neuroscience, the brain can't make sense of the punch. The brain just feels the punch and sends signals to your body to experience the punch. The meaning of the punch can only be arrived at through a story. And the reason I use a punch is because it's such a quick thing. There's not a whole lot of time to think about it, which is why we need to be conscious, become conscious in our daily lives about how we are making up meaning. And I don't mean we are inventing it out of nothing. What we're doing is we're taking this thing and that thing and another thing, and we're putting them together and constructing, this is what that means. Most of us are unconscious of this for most of our lives. Many of the stories that we unconsciously imbibe are not true or not helpful. Some of the basic stories that our culture replicates are us versus them. Get them before they get at you. This is the worst time in history to be alive. There's nothing you can do to change things, and you have to be the one that saves the world, even though there's nothing you can do to change things. Or it's all their fault, and it has nothing to do with me. Or history only began yesterday, which means, like, if I did something to you yesterday, all that matters is what happened yesterday, not what happened a week ago or a thousand years ago, you know. And why I think about that is because of the troubles and the conflict in the north of Ireland and on the island of Ireland and about the island of Ireland. Even the way I use that phraseology is part of my conscious attempt at making meaning, because when people say the Northern Ireland troubles or the conflict about Northern Ireland, they're reducing the possibility that it might have to do with other people too. That it might have to do with English people as well, that it might have to do with people who live in the Republic of Ireland and who weren't as directly affected by the conflict. Most of the violence from 1968 onwards took place in the northeast of the island. It had to do with the US as well, because successive US presidential administrations sent supportive diplomats over, and a lot of Irish American people with affection for Ireland had, I would say, fairly blunt views about Ireland that may or may not have been helpful to those of us who were actually living there. So even the phraseology we use, you know, the Northern Ireland conflict, as opposed to the violent civil conflict and the sociological divisions in and about Northern Ireland and the north of Ireland, because different people call it different things. It's similar to when somebody says she didn't get that job because she's a woman. Well, is it possible that it might be more truthful to say she didn't get that job because of misogyny on part of the people who were doing the hiring?
Yeah.
It's not because she's a woman, or he didn't get that because he's black. No, he didn't get that because of racism. And I've experienced discrimination, not because I'm queer, but because of homophobia and biphobia. So that it's a subtle shift of language, but it actually changes all the power dynamics. Absolutely. There. Those are just some examples that are fairly everyday to me, and I hope they convey, you can actually change the meaning of a thing by the way you talk about it. Political propagandists have known this forever.
Absolutely.
And I'm not talking about using the tools in order to create more manipulative propaganda. I'm talking about if we become conscious of the stories we're telling and ask ourselves two simple questions: are they true? And if not, is there a truer version? And is this the most helpful way I can tell the story? And if not, what is a more helpful way that I could tell it? You will change the meaning of your life. You will change how you show up in the lives of others. You may become less afraid of some things. You may become more concerned about some other things. But you won't be buffeted around by the tornado of somebody else's propaganda. You will be claiming, I was going to say, your own story. I don't mean that in a selfish, possessive, individualistic way, because it has to be done in community. You can't do it by yourself. You should check it out with other people. But it's best to choose other people who you think are a wee bit wiser than you are. And there's loads of people wiser than me, so it's quite easy for me to find people who can help me with my stories.
So living by those stories that have been created in our culture, that are being fed by our politicians, just being able to step back and ask yourself questions about those stories, makes a huge difference as we go forward. But I've never thought about it that way until the last few years, and I think a lot of us don't. What is being told in the story today that worries you, that gives you hope?
Oh yeah, that's a great question too. And I want to say, like, I mean, some of our politicians are telling us that, and I think some of them are doing it because they're consciously trying to manipulate people, and a lot of them are doing it because they believe the story. Like, I don't, you know, maybe I'm naive. I don't think that there is a large manipulative, consciously manipulative cabal living in a bunker somewhere planning the future of the world. I really don't. And one of the evidence I have for that is that people have always thought that kind of thing, and we haven't yet been able to find where this cabal is. And there have always been conspiracy theories. It's not a conspiracy theory when it turns out to be true, but you know, things are a lot more mundane, I think, than they're often presented to be. I mean, part of the reason for the 9/11 conspiracy theories is a completely natural response to the terrifying trauma of those events. People want to have a bigger explanation than just 20 guys were able to hijack planes and carry out that monstrous act. That's terrifying to think that just 20 guys could do that. I understand the terror of that. So it makes sense that people would want to have, well, no, there must be some bigger explanation behind that, because that's actually less scary. The scary hidden cabal running the world is less scary than reality, because reality is no one's running the world. Potentially, if you look at things through a secular lens, no one's running the world, and we're running the world. And so we have to take responsibility for our lives. We have to take responsibility for what we're going to introduce into the system. Václav Havel, the first president of the Free Czech Republic, great poet and playwright, talked about the capacity to say, I, me, is the tool with which I inscribe onto the great panorama of being, right? That's a very highfalutin way of saying you have something to offer the story. You're not just a victim or a recipient of the story. You have something to offer it. So what we're having, what the container that we're being invited to offer into today, the stories that give me hope, the stories that concern me, hope I see in the form of more people are awakening to this question of what's the story I can learn to consciously tell. Hope I see in the form of people being able to be vulnerable about their imperfections and needs in public. You know, wasn't that long ago that if a political figure told the truth about their personal life, they would be immediately, you know, not able to win an election. Now, I think it's more possible for people running for office to say, yes, I have these flaws, I'm working on them, or this painful thing happened to me, or let me show you my heart. And that won't necessarily lead to them not being elected. We have to do a bit more discernment about is some what you do with your flaws. You know, some of your flaws you just have to own and say, look, I'm always going to be this way.
Yeah.
I'm going to be accountable for how that manifests in the world, but can you just give me some...
Yeah, this is me.
Be patient with me. And then there's other things that aren't flaws, but they are vulnerable to talk about. Like when, I remember when the Prime Minister of the Netherlands took time off work with depression.
Hmm.
He was the first national political leader I ever heard of who'd done that. What a tremendous gift he gave to his country and to anybody that knew about that, to say, I'm not well at the moment and I'm going to take care of myself and signal to the rest of the world that that's what you should do too, that it's legitimate when you're in need to ask for your needs to be be met, not to be shamed for it.
Yeah.
We've got a problem at the moment because there's a difference between that and someone saying, you know, I don't care what you think about my flaws, or, you know, what's it to you? I'm going to be a bully. And that we've got to be able to tell the difference between that and someone being honest about their vulnerabilities and saying, I need help with these.
There is a story out there that refuses to allow us to be that kind of vulnerable. Kristen Cobes de May, I talked to her a couple of years ago about her book and the whole
Jesus and John Wayne.
And the whole John Wayne thing. Is about invulnerability. So we see that manifesting in Trump and in so many people who are pushing a kind of toxic masculinity on our kids and in our communities and in our politics.
Yeah.
So America is the best, the elite. Uh-huh. We're the most powerful and we flex our muscles, we bully. But I think we're also in a time when people are saying, I don't know, is that really the story we want to be telling? Well, is that the life we want to live?
And like, you know, the good alternative to toxic masculinity is not no masculinity.
Right.
It's healthy masculinity.
Exactly.
And, you know, and what we could have another discussion another day about broadening the definition of masculinity, and that we shouldn't equate masculinity with biological maleness, because these are just, it's just a word that refers to archetypal reality, and it doesn't matter what gender you are. You can be toxic, or I shouldn't say that. You can manifest in toxic ways. We've just evolved this word masculine to refer to certain kinds of things, and feminine to refer to other kinds of things. Part of the problem is we've tended to say masculine is strong and feminine is weak. I don't think that's a helpful way of thinking about life. I'd rather think in terms of toxic and honorable or aggressive versus holding boundaries, you know, and I, you know, I would want to say, I mean, there've been people who've written, there are certain kinds of men who are the kind of John Wayne type and who are trying to kind of present a way of being a man that they think is kind of the warrior archetype and the whole archetype and the one that men should follow and that everything else is weak. And I want to say to those guys, look, I understand the legitimate need that you're trying to get met here. You're trying to say something about what it means to be a person in this society, to be a person of integrity. And I'd want to say to them, there's a whole lot of ways to be a man. There's a whole lot of ways to be a woman. There's a whole lot of ways to be anywhere on the gender spectrum. The question is, are you moving towards stories of union rather than separation, towards stories of responsibility where you own your part? And you bring your part and you acknowledge your needs and ask for help around those needs. If you're a rampaging bull in a china shop by kind of your emotional training, if you're the kind of person who flies off the handle at a minute's notice, you are responsible for dealing with the impact of that. And I don't want to hear any excuses from you, John Wayne or no John Wayne, about the painful impact that you have on the world. At the same time, by the same token, I'd like to help you transform that flying off the handle about, I don't know, being cut off in traffic or someone being late for a meeting or I don't like the other political side. Transform that anger and channel it into things that are worth being angry about, like poverty, like racism, like people who are living traumatized by just being bombarded by stories of pain and horror in the world. Find a way to channel your anger on their behalf, not in a violent way. Find a way to hold boundaries, not in an aggressive perpetrating way, be that kind of man. And like, I don't have any problem with that at all. But I'm damn sure don't have a problem with my way of being a man. I welcome your feedback over issues of integrity.
Yeah.
Not over issues of style.
Yeah.
Not over issues of whether I like poetry, you know, a so-called feminine thing.
Yeah.
Or whether I like the more recent Godzilla movie, Godzilla Minus One, a Japanese movie, a so-called masculine thing, right? Or whether I like gardening, or whether I like handy person activities around the house. Those are issues of style.
Yeah.
They're not issues of substance. The substance issue is, are you harming other people consciously or unconsciously? Grow up. That's what I want to say to the John Wayne guys. If you want to grow, I'll help you grow up, and we can grow up together, because I got some growing up to do too. So that question, the vulnerability piece, is what gives me hope. The willingness of people to pay attention to the needs of others, especially people who have occupied positions of power and privilege in our society, who seem to be noticing the needs of others, seem to be becoming a wee bit more aware that there are other people that don't have those resources. And when you start noticing that, you might start asking, why do they not have those resources? And did I earn all the things I have? Or am I basically a legacy admission to the school of privilege?
Yeah.
That's not a bad little phrase, by the way.
That's a great phrase. Like, you know, I was just thinking, I'm going to use that.
you can use it. You can use it.
It's a sermon phrase. Right
don't spend your life feeling guilty about being a legacy admission to the school of privilege. Just use your friggin' privilege.
Exactly.
You have to beep out words on this show, right?
Friggin' is fine.
Friggin' is fine, okay. Yeah. But you would beep out other words?
Well, maybe one.
Okay, use your fucking privilege. like to serve.
We'll see if we have to beep that out.
Okay, I think you probably do. Just use it to serve the needs of others. Yeah. Ask them what they need and how can you share what you've got.
Yeah.
And if you, and where you lack things, go look for the people who are safe to ask how they can support you. Now, those are some of the hopeful things. Yeah. And then the vibrancy of the stories of people who have been historically marginalized and who've been on the fringes of society, now coming into the center of society, where there is more racial diversity and more gender diversity and more sexual orientation diversity, more political diversity. Actually, there's more ways to be progressive than there have been before, and there are more ways to be conservative. There's even the possibility, I'm going to say something radical, there is the possibility that the most noble and honorable parts of conservatism and the most noble and honorable parts of what we might call progressivism could actually find some common ground.
Yeah.
It's conservative to value community, and we need interdependent community.
Yeah.
It's conservative to look after the earth. What's it called, for absolutely God's sake? Conservation, right? Okay.
And I both come out of Christian backgrounds.
Yeah.
And there's, you see people on both sides of these issues who are claiming Jesus is them.
Jesus
is a conservative. Come on. Jesus is a progressive. But maybe it's just because we're seeing bits and pieces of Jesus who fit our particular story, glomming onto them and excluding other stuff. So,
we all should take a look in the mirror and say, come on, really, Gareth, really?
Yeah.
Like, and ask yourself, what is love and what makes for more love in the world? And if love, properly defined, includes the willingness to stretch yourself for the sake of the needs of others, that's what, I mean, you can't, there's no definition of, there's no meaningful definition of love that excludes the idea of me putting my needs second for the sake of others, right? Yeah. Now, the beautiful thing is, if I love you and you love me, you're going to put your needs second for the sake of me, so it is a virtuous circle.
Yeah.
Other than that, it's a kind of martyrdom where I put my needs aside and even deny my needs. So I'd be quite happy if political parties, if you somehow could get an overhead projector slide in which the definition of love was put in a translucent way on top of all our political policies, and it would erase everything that doesn't move the world toward more love. And people, again, they're going to say, oh, that's weak, which is, you know, they're being sexist when they say that, because what they really mean is that's feminine, right? And to which I'd say two things. First of all, love has guided all the meaningful social movements in history, mm-hmm. from the more recent Black civil rights movement in the United States through Florence Nightingale, through Francis of Assisi, Julian of Norwich, as far back as you can go, the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
And the second thing is many of the most heroic, boundary-holding, sacred, non-violent or peaceful warriors have been women.
Hmm.
Okay, so great, call me feminine. I take it as a compliment.
Yeah.
And to sort of go to the things that scare me or that concern me in the stories in the world, it's the story that entrenches them versus us.
Yeah.
And it's the story that says we have to defeat them so that us can hold the purity.
Yeah.
What proceeds from that is, at the individual level, a lot of depression and loss and no capacity for ever feeling we've achieved enough to be able to be okay with what we have. And worse than that, it's the foundation for authoritarian populism and fascism. And fascism can happen across the political spectrum, and we have to define that too. Fascism for me is the institutionalization of the belief that some lives are worth more than others, which of course means that some lives are worth less than others.
Yeah.
We have to evolve political structures that enshrine the absolute equal value of every life. We haven't done that yet.
Constitution aspires to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And we have to back that up with action, right? We can't just say it.
Exactly.
But you have to back it up with action. And a life doesn't start, this is not a point, I was going to say a life doesn't start when you're born. This is not a point about reproductive rights or abortion. That I'm making, that's another conversation. A life doesn't start when you're born. A life starts 3, 7, 10 generations ago.
Hmm.
And a life doesn't end when you die. It has a legacy into the future.
Yeah.
And so it isn't fair or just for me to say to you, Chuck, you know, you're 100% responsible for everything that's happened in your life entirely by yourself. Yeah. Not true.
No.
Both your mistakes and your achievements had a context.
Yeah.
And what comes after you will, and what came before you will. So we're not being truthful if we define people as, you know, automatons or robots.
Or rugged individuals.
No, absolutely true. No such thing. No American. Such thing. Rugged individuals always had help. Yes. Always.
Yes.
You know, even like, and any novelist worth their salt knows they didn't write the book by themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it, you know, you sometimes see in acknowledgements sections in books, people say, you know, thank you to all these people who helped me. They made the book better than it could be. And then they say, any errors that remain are entirely my own. No, that's actually not true because it's still a group effort, you know. I understand what they're saying. And then, so, you know, you get the rise of authoritarian populism. You get the rise of fascism, you get the possibility of nuclear war, which and that's a misnomer because there wouldn't be any such thing as a nuclear war. There would just be a nuclear attack and then a response, and then we'd be done.
Yeah.
And that's the worst case scenario in terms of things that human beings can press buttons to do that would be over in a matter of minutes.
Yep.
But there's something even bigger than that, and that is the climate crisis.
Yes.
And human beings are contributing to that. And human beings are also mitigating it. So as James Allison said at this gathering yesterday, if you were in a room where people were playing Wagner and Rossini at the same time, you'd only be able to hear the Wagner. So my last part of response to what concerns me or what gives me hope, is that the Rossini is playing the positive, the beautiful, the connected, the vulnerable, the courageous, the self-sacrificing, the love. That noise is playing.
Mm.
There's just a kind of an aggressive noise that's being played that sounds louder. And the thing that worries me the most is that we'll be so distracted by the loudest noises that we will, A, not benefit from the kinder noises that other people are playing for our benefit, and B, we will spend more of our time trying to oppose the loud noises. And what does opposition sound like? Opposition sounds like more loud noise. We probably do need to oppose things sometimes.
Yeah.
But I think a lot less than we currently do. It's much better for us to join the Rossini band and make our own contribution to the better noise, to the noise that will bring us more toward union and love than the noise that will just defeat some of our fellow people.
Which doesn't really progress us. Let me finish this wonderful conversation with this. So my goal in doing what I do with podcasting, I'm not making money. I'm not getting famous. I want to lift
up. You're famous to me.
I want to lift up. I want to lift up the stories of people like you who are doing things that amplify the Rossini music, the beautiful music in life. And there are so many of them. Mm-hmm. One of the things I found in Erie, we're lifting up the stories of people who are doing great things in our little city. So many of them are being done by young women. Mm-hmm. This powerful, powerful cohort of people in Erie, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Straight, queer, single, married, family people. Just all of these young women, 40s, 40 and under, who have stepped up to take leadership roles in quiet ways are making a huge difference in our community, and nobody knows about it. So everybody thinks Erie's going to hell in a handbasket.
Yep.
It's not. Yep. So anyway, thank you for your time, Garrett. It's always fun to talk to you.
You don't have time for one more little story?
I do. Right. I mean, I'm great.
So that reminds me of a lovely story that I heard from the horse's mouth. When Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip were still alive, probably about 10 years ago, they visited East Belfast, which is working class Protestant. And a friend of mine was involved in a major project for, urban transformation for the common good. They were building a wonderful center that had a community meeting space, a really good cafe. I guess you'd call it social housing, so people who maybe couldn't afford to have a decent place to live, and other kind of community oriented businesses and nonprofits would have space in this building too. And the building is now complete. It's really, really beautiful. They did great work. And the Queen and Prince Philip were invited over to come and look at it while it was still at the architectural model stage. So maybe it's more like 15 years ago. And apparently the royal family and do things like that. Like they, the royal family is in touch with civil servants. They don't just do what they want to do. And I'm not a monarchist by any stretch of the imagination. I do think it's really good that if you have a public platform, you should use it for the common good. But apparently they will often come in at the point where the funders are going to make a decision. Are we going to give a lot of money to this project or not? And if the Queen and Prince Philip show up, or now if King Charles and Camilla or one of the junior royals show up just before the funder makes the decision and the funder is invited to that meeting and they meet the Queen, I think it sort of helps with the thing happening. So anyway, some very positive things happened on that day. And then later that day, they visited another part of Belfast that would be more from the community that would be considered on the other side of things, the Catholic community. And I hope I'm remembering this story rightly. And my friend who had hosted the Queen and Prince Philip earlier that day, busiest day of the year, and they did get the funding, right?
Oh, cool.
Busiest day of the year. Maybe busiest day of his life. He was in the little newsagent and candy store across the street at about probably 6:30 that afternoon, tired, probably just getting himself a chocolate bar to have on the way home. And there was a small television behind the counter where the person at the checkout had the news on. And there was a kind of a stalwart elderly woman from the community standing in line in front of him. And she was watching the news. And there'd be a lot of rivalry between our communities in Northern Ireland. And she didn't know that the Queen and Prince Philip had been across the street for probably 3 hours earlier that day. And 3 hours is a lot for a queen. She's got a lot to do. And she's standing in line, and the news broadcast is just coming to the end of the item about this is what the Queen and Prince Philip did today. And the end of the item was that they'd gone to this. It was maybe a Catholic school they'd gone to or something like that. And that's all that this customer saw, was the Queen and Prince Philip had gone to a Catholic school. And she just goes, ha! Typical. You never see the Queen and Prince Philip coming to our part of town. They're always going to the other side. And to which my friend Glenn, whom I love and whom I miss, he, Glenn, has subsequently died. Mm. Glenn said, well, actually, they were across the street for like half the day, at which point she completely changed her demeanor and said, oh, well, that's just lovely. You know, I've always liked the Queen. And so, you know, and we can all do that.
Yeah.
And we can all say Erie's going to hell in a handbasket because we're not looking. Maybe we just didn't see.
Yeah.
Or maybe Rossini doesn't sound as loud as Wagner.
Yeah.
And I like a bit of Wagner, but Wagner's often the same note.
Yeah.
You know, over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
There's some flair and some room and some elasticity.
Yeah.
In other kinds of music. Hmm. And we maybe just need to get them in the right proportion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy to listen to Wagner 5% of the time. But it's not the whole story.
Yeah. Yeah. Good stuff. Well, Erie will be glad to have had the chance to hear you.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be able to share anything.
It's just
in this context.
It's sweet.
So that was my conversation with Gareth Higgins, and there will be more where that came from. In the weeks to come, we'll share some of the other conversations I had at that conference. But also in the weeks to come, Marcus and I and others will be talking about the big issues facing our community and our democracy in this momentous election year. You can find Next 2.0 with current and archived episodes on all of the major streaming platforms each Friday, and on the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 p.m. on NPR WQLN Erie at 91.3 FM. And lastly, before I get out of here, I want to let you know that Marcus has started a new feature. If you want to comment on this show or any previous shows, if you want to make suggestions for future shows, you can call the Next hotline at 814-240-8816 and leave us a message. Thanks. Have a good one.